don't you get up, don't you let win.
Greetings, friends. Thanks for joining Jack Tuckner and Deborah O'Rell, the women's rights in the workplace activists, where although things are precarious outside, they're a little less so in our studio, especially today when we're joined by Marianne Schnall, a highly regarded journalist who has been at the forefront of issues related to women's leadership for decades. Marianne has interviewed everyone from Maya Angelou to Melinda Gates and most recently President Jimmy Carter and Arianna Huffington as part of her ongoing coverage that has been featured in publications ranging from The Huffington Post to Time Magazine and Oh, the Oprah Magazine. Marianne's first book was Daring to Be Ourselves, Influential Women Share Insights on Courage, Happiness, and Finding Your Own Voice, which included a collection of interviews of reputable women leaders and which inspired the format of What Will It Take to Make a Woman President? Conversations about women, leadership, and power, which was built around the question posed by her 8-year-old daughter following the election of President Obama. Marianne is also founder of Feminist.com, which was started in 1995, working with a team of influential women and organizations, and is currently working to grow her book into a larger movement and organization to harness the ideas of the women and men she has interviewed and to advance the cause of women's leadership in partnership with Political Parity and other national organizations across the country. Marianne's latest book is, as I mentioned, What Will It Take to Make a Woman President? Conversations about Women, Leadership, and Power, and it features interviews with politicians, public officials, thought leaders, writers, artists, and activists in an attempt to discover the obstacles that have held women back and what needs to change in order to elect a woman into the White House. With insights and personal anecdotes from Sheryl Sandberg, Maya Angelou, Gloria Steinem, Nancy Pelosi, Nicholas Kristof, Melissa Etheridge, Olympia Snow, and many more, this book addresses timely, provocative issues involving women, politics, and power, with a broader goal of encouraging women and girls to be leaders in their lives, their communities, and the larger world. Schnall and her interviewees explore the changing paradigms occurring in politics and in our culture with the hope of moving toward meaningful and effective solutions and a world where women can be president, or the President of the United States. Through her writings, interviews, and websites, Marianne strives to raise awareness and inspire activism around important issues and causes. Marianne, welcome to our show. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So in 2008, after President Obama was elected to his first term of office, your 8-year-old daughter, Lotus, asked you, why haven't we ever had a woman president? That's what inspired you to write this book?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, I hadn't even thought that I was going to do a book on this. It just sort of, that was sort of moment stuck in my head at the time. You know, it was, as I said, you know, right after Barack Obama was elected president, and we were just reflecting on how remarkable it was to have our first African-American president, and she just turned to me, and it was this very sort of innocent, obvious-sounding question, you know, why haven't we ever had a woman president? And you would think, you know, my decades of working on these women's issues, I'd have some simple answer, but it turned out to, it just stuck with me, and I thought, I might work this into, you know, an interview one day. And then I guess just, you know, maybe it was like a year or two later, I was covering an event at the Women's Media Center, and I was doing a piece for CNN, and I decided to work it into my questions. So I was asking some of the people who were there that ranged from Sheryl Sandberg and Arianna Huffington, Gloria Steinem, Jane Fonda, a bunch of others, you know, what do you think it will take to make a woman president? Why haven't we ever had a woman president? And then afterwards, I got some more reflections from, like, Nancy Pelosi and Kirsten Gillibrand, and I put it up at CNN in this very narrow vertical called Gender and Identity. But what happened was it got so much traffic, it wound up on the homepage. And the next time I spoke to my agent with all of my questions about what I thought my next book should be, he was like, this is your next book. And I said, I don't know if I should do that book, and what would I be doing that book? And he said, if you can just try to get some commitments from some of your sort of high-level people that you have access to, I think I can, you know, get you a book deal. So I, you know, contacted Gloria Steinem and Marie Wilson and all these people I respect who said not only would they grant me interviews, but that, you know, this was a project worth doing. So that's how it started, and it has been a really amazing journey that apparently seems to, you know, be continuing in all sorts of unexpected and wonderful ways.
That's terrific. Well, it is a fascinating book, and I noticed as I was reading it last night, you know, you have, you know, an additional, I mean, this is such a critical mass of the talent across a wide spectrum from Sandra Fluck to Eleanor Holmes Norton, Elizabeth Lesser, Kirsten Gillibrand. So was there, you know, and I have some specific questions about what some of them, you know, how they answer the question, because the question was essentially each time the same question, right? What would it take to be a woman, to get a woman president in the United States, to elect a woman?
Well, it definitely was customized to the people I was talking to. I mean, I think I probably did ask that question to everybody, but then it was really different in terms of, obviously, there's a lot of other questions that I asked during those interviews, and those were kind of customized, whether I was talking to, you know, a female senator or to a musician like Melissa Etheridge, you know, to, you know, someone like Gloria Steinem. So, you know, but so everybody had their different perspective, and what I really discovered was that question was this lens into so many different interconnecting themes that are sort of affecting not only women, but just the changing paradigms in our culture and in politics today. And so it really did require looking at it from all of those angles and, you know, having sort of a wider conversation. And that's why it was important for me to include men, and I, you know, interviewed several men. And I tried to be bipartisan and all of these, you know, really important so that we really had a full spectrum of looking at it from a lot of different angles.
Mm-hmm. Well, so was there a particular distillation of some nuggets that you took away from? How many were there, maybe 40-some or 30-some on interviews?
Well, what wound up happening is because everybody kept giving me more and more people to talk to, literally. I mean, it was like just giving me suggestions, making entrees. I was supposed to do 20 interviews, but it wound up becoming 60 interviews. So there's actually an e-book version. I think there's about 30 in the print book, and then there's like an additional, like, you know, 20 or something that are in the e-book.
That's the book I have, and it's still going on.
I mean, I'm going to be doing some interviews for some online hubs in connection to the book. So, you know, everybody had something interesting to say on this topic. It's, you know, obviously very timely.
So, of course, when you look at the, and I know, I believe you mentioned at the beginning of the book that how sort of dismal we are, you know, as a first world country by comparison in terms of at least, you know, electability of women to leadership roles and functions, particularly president, when you have, I believe you mentioned, in England, Margaret Thatcher was elected prime minister three times. Then you have a long list of countries, Argentina, Iceland, the Philippines, Nicaragua, Ecuador, Finland, etc., where in South Korea, female heads of states have been elected, and we lag way behind. Was that, so that is sort of a backdrop of, to, it's sort of that cognitive dissonance, and, you know, for many of our listeners who haven't read your book, what was the sort of, was there a, and with this kind of wide range of folks that were answering the question, what is the reason that you think, having interviewed the greatest thought leaders in North America, that we at this time still haven't had a woman elected president?
Well, what I discovered is that there wasn't just one simple answer, which is why maybe it required, you know, will end up being so many interviews and pages to try to figure it out. But there were some, you know, sort of common takeaways that sort of kept reoccurring. So, you know, I mean, some that occur to me are things like we need to encourage women and girls to see themselves as leaders. They really do not receive those messages in our culture, and so that, you know, they don't often, you know, not only see themselves that way, but don't think to run for office. They often, you know, think that they don't necessarily have the confidence to take such a, you know, courageous step as to, you know, run for office. They need extra encouragement. But, and also the connection of that to the role of the media, because certainly the women don't see themselves that way oftentimes because of these very, you know, sort of destructive images and messages that they receive from the media, which objectify women and sexualize women and all of these things that not only impact how women and girls see themselves, but also how men and boys view women. And so there was definitely the sense of needing to monitor the portrayal of women in the media. And then there were just, you know, so there were some psychological issues, and then there were some structural issues. There's definitely conversation around the need to support, you know, women in the workplace, whether it's, you know, issues like pay equity or policies and programs that support working women and families. We heard a lot of even the women's senators say about how hard it is to, you know, have a family and, you know, campaign and run for office. And so that means that not only do we need sort of better policies around family leave and, you know, affordable child care, but also we need to reframe that men feel like they can share in those responsibilities. There was a lot of talk about, you know, changing gender roles for men as much as women, so that men aren't really encouraged to share in those roles, even though they might naturally be inclined to or want to. And then, I mean, there were a lot of, topics that came up regarding, whether it was campaign finance reform and creating a just friendlier environment. I mean, these days it is just brutal to try to run for office, the money that's required to raise, and just what you're up against. Many women don't want to subject themselves to that. And so, I mean, as I said, you know, everybody had a different take on it, but I think overall it wound up being, you know, a lens into, even though we think that in this country we're so progressive, there's almost become like a little bit of an apathy. I remember, you know, interviewing, you know, someone like, Sheryl Sandberg, who, you know, of course, been leaning in. But, even in the corporate world, those numbers are just as low. You know, we may only have 20, you know, female senators. But the numbers are all below 20% in terms of, you know, women in the corporate world as well, in terms of numbers of, women, CEOs or Fortune 500 companies and boards. So, you know, it's almost like we don't even, you first have to acknowledge there's a problem and then, you know, try to figure out how we can fix it. But the good news is that people felt like we're headed in the right direction. It just needs, like, awareness and proactive push.
But isn't the problem when you look at, and you mentioned this, when you say that I've used a woman president as a symbol, that the book was also looking at the broader goal of encouraging women and girls as leaders and, in their own lives and in communities and in the larger world. So if exploring these changing paradigms in politics and culture, and I know what you're talking about. Obviously, it's not as simple. You didn't ask this question for people to say, oh, we simply need to have more women in lower elective office, or we simply need to promote more women or take money out of politics. It's all connected. So if all of these, when you mention we consider ourselves a progressive nation, well, many of us progressives no longer actually think that. If you look at just the indicators across all of the progressive factors that comprise an actual, country that is taking care of its citizenry, we fall sort of close to dead last, particularly things like paid maternity leave, et cetera, as we know. So, I said the question is, does it beg the question, or is it just a useful lens? Because it's not the women, right? It's not a female, as Joy Behar noted in your interview. We had Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin. No one would argue, right? Us progressives wouldn't say that by virtue of their gender they would be better for women in elective office as the president. No,
absolutely. I mean, I think I tried to make that point time and time again. This isn't about just, like, you know, any woman, and it is more about, you know, I think it was Gloria Steinem who pointed out to me, you know, it's about the consciousness, it's not about the gender. That said, it's almost like it needs to be reframed. This is a matter of just having a reflective, you know, democracy. It's a matter of diversity. You know, women are 51% of the population, and we're just not equally represented. So, just having more women leaders in general is what's needed. And so this was not a comment on, you know, my personal opinion on, you know, who should run and who we should elect, but more just that we should at least have a fair shot to be at the table. And I do think one of the things that I took away was that this has to be reframed not anymore as a women's issue. This is a human issue. And this is something that benefits, that's what Nicholas Kristof said, it's not something that benefits just the women of America, it benefits all of America. And men increasingly, I think, are understanding that and, you know, being very supportive. I think anybody can agree that there's a lot of dysfunction right now in Washington and in our country and in the world. And, you know, so I think that anybody can, you know, we all feel that there is a need for change. And this hopefully is part of that change. And having elected our African-American president, first African-American president twice, it's still a hopeful sign. We just need to see, you know, different faces up there that reflect the electorate that, politics is trying to serve.
Right. Well, diversity, you know, for the same reason, I suppose, and some of your interviewees pointed out, we don't have, if you look at, and I see this in my travels around to various law firms in the city when I am either, you know, involved in a deposition or a mediation, and all you have to do is look at even the law firm that we are tenants in, the firm where there are 25 or 30 some odd partners, two are female. So it's sort of the same low representation when we've been graduating more women than men from law schools for the last 25 years. It's the same problematic issue, isn't it? It's the same sort of insidious I mean, that's it's no different mm-hmm. than the fact that we have, what is the, I think you cite the statistics of elective office. Well, how many females do we currently have, you know, in the Senate or House of Representatives percentage?
Well, I mean, we're 18% in Congress, so, you know, mm-hmm. that's really ridiculously low. That's
right.
Nowhere even near. You know, and we
right.
celebrated the, you know, 20 female senators because it was history making. And, you know, right. obviously, I mean, a lot of the female senators themselves said to me, that's really nothing to celebrate.
right.
It's great
right.
to be making progress, but it is just so slow. But yeah, it is connected. And I do think that there are, you know, it's a really, there were so many conundrums I ran into in looking at this issue. Because while we're saying that you need to encourage women and girls to see themselves as leader, then you see how powerful, ambitious women are depicted as unlikable and are attacked, whether it's someone like Nancy Pelosi or Hillary Clinton. I mean, there are so many examples. So it's this real catch-22. And mm-hmm. I think part of it is that we just need more women leaders doing it in all their different ways. And also, as I think it was Gloria Steinem who pointed out to me, to just, you know, not care so much what everybody thinks, because it seems like when you step out there, oftentimes you are going to get attacked, and not every woman wants to subject themselves to that. But I think women, you know, I've been hearing, you know, just what women really need right now is courage to just, you know, put themselves out there, you know, if they're called to do that, and for leadership in all sorts of ways. I just recently interviewed Kirsten Gillibrand about a new book that she has coming out, and she was, you know, saying that it's just as important to be a leader in your community or, you know, on the PTA and, yeah, in your company or just in your life. Like, women just need to start valuing their voices and feeling like they should, you know, contribute their talents and skills and wisdom to the world.
So one of the ways that we can promote that is by having leaders generally in elective office or our leaders that do promote that regardless of their gender. So when it comes to, you know, issues of, and I think the question, it kind of came up, it was, you were discussing it sort of almost collaterally about the idea of, if, for instance, Hillary. Would you support Hillary, Marianne, in the 2016 election if a viable alternative were someone like, for instance, Bernie Sanders?
Well, I definitely, it's, I mean, I do not think it's for my best interest or the interest of the book. I've been trying to really steer away from my own political preferences or leanings.
Okay.
But that said, here's what I'll say about Hillary, because there's been no question that you can't talk about this topic without thinking of Hillary. And I think that in a lot of ways, in fact, a lot of people that I spoke to, you know, you would ask them, do you think you'll see a woman president in your lifetime? And they would answer, well, if Hillary runs, yes. If not, I'm not so sure. That was a little dispiriting, you know, to me.
Right.
But the point is also that a lot of people, whether it was Nancy Pelosi or Kirsten Gillibrand, said that, you know, if she did run, that she would go down as being one of the most well-prepared presidents in our history. You know, she's definitely, and we got to see what happened to her in the 2008 election. I mean, I think everyone can agree that there was a lot of sexism and, you know, how she was covered. And she toughed it through. And no matter what happens, if, you know, whether she runs or whether she wins, the fact that we have a visual that it's starting to feel mm-hmm. possible, I think, you know, for my daughters, is just,
right.
you know, is a positive development. And, you know, again, it's not, it's never been about Hillary. I think there are a lot of other women on both sides of the aisle that could make great candidates. But again, you know, I've noticed that every time an article runs about my book, you know, there's always a picture of Hillary on there, you know,
right.
and I understand
right.
that.
Right. Right. Well, it's about, I think as Nancy Pelosi said in your book, it's about diversity, and it is, as you mentioned, and it's about bringing in, you know, the more, whether women think differently than men, I believe she pointed out, and bringing in enough of, again, that critical mass of that mix. And I think most of us feel that, notwithstanding some, you know, outlier women, that if you, more women as part of these, you know, in terms of our, both our state houses and in the White House and in Congress, would inure to all of our, you know, our benefits, because of women perhaps are a little bit less either, you know, warlike or tend to be somewhat less. Do you think women are less conservative than men in general?
Well, the hardest thing in doing this book, I think, was steering away from generalizations. And I kept trying to just, you know, make sure that because and that was, you know, a hard thing to do in this book, because to say that all women are one way or all men are one way is just, you know, not accurate. But what I did hear over and over again was women tend to, you know, be consensus builders. Women tend to maybe pursue, you know, more peaceful solutions first. And again, these are all generalizations. It's hard to say, you know, that these things are true. And certainly there are men that are exhibit those qualities as well. But, you know, I think it was one of the most interesting and almost disheartening things that I think was Anita Hill said to me was she wondered if in the first female president would actually have to overprove her toughness while she was there and be more warlike, you know, because we've only seen power and leadership in the way that, you know, quote, you know, men have done it. You know, what I would hope is no matter what her, you know, natural qualities are, that women would bring that to the table in her leadership. But what I remember hearing from, you know, I keep referencing Gloria Steinem, but, you know, she knows this area, of course, but, you know, she just, a lot of people made the point that we bring our own experiences, and right now there are a lot of people, like, you know, legislating on issues that impact women's experiences, whether it's around sexual assault or it's about reproductive issues or health issues or issues that are in the workplace or children, and these are things that women can speak to. You need to have women there because we bring our own unique set of experiences that men can just not talk to. And that's why having Kirsten Gillibrand speaking out against, you know, sexual assault in the military, you know, adds value to the conversation.
Right.
And so I think that's sort of what more I heard. And in terms of, you know, whether women or, you know, about being more conservative, less conservative, again, I think that we need all different types of women in leadership of all different stripes.
Well, and it's also what women can do in terms of changing the conversation, the tone, the topic, just the simple approach to it. I mean, that was one of Marianne Williamson, one of what propelled her to begin to run, was the need to change the conversation, whether it's left or right or whatever. It's women approach things differently. In it, recently with the stalemates in Congress, it's been small clusters of women who have gotten together and worked out a deal that men alone hadn't seemed to be able to forge.
So, yeah, I mean, the negotiations over the shutdown were spearheaded by Susan Collins, you know, a Republican female senator, and the other whole bipartisan effort of those female senators. And also, people seem to also talk a lot about what you're just saying is very true, you know, the need to not just do power the way it's been done, but to, you know, a lot of people talked about, you know, just redefining how we think of power, you know, sort of this less about power over, but power to, that maybe that was something else that, you know, women could bring to the table, that that's how oftentimes, and again, not making generalizations, but women do sometimes see and use power differently. So it can only, you know, it can only help at this point. You know, as I keep repeating this phrase that I heard Robin Morgan say, but because, you know, we need all hands on deck. I feel like everybody, look at, there's so many problems that we're facing, and why would we want to squander the, you know, the talents and ideas that women, half of the population, would bring to solving some of these problems?
And that's exactly why it seems to me that women are not given the opportunity, because a strong woman, again, this is a generalization, tends to intimidate people just based on how a strong woman is described versus a strong man. I mean, we've all read, you know, bossy, bitchy versus powerful, you know, in terms of describing a man. And often it seems to me, and I think some of your interviews pointed out as well, what deters women, what turns them off, is the structure that's set up is very testosterone power based, that women do not feel invited or comfortable with that kind of power. So you need those, and again, using Hillary as those first you know, soldiers that storm the beach that break the way, just as Jesse Jackson and all of the black male leaders that came forward to pave the way so that this country could see the possibility of an African-American president. Women, we need those first batch of women to storm the beach, to clear the path, to begin to change the construct, to change that environment.
Mm-hmm. Right? I think it's a movement that's happening. And as I said, what's happened out of this book, you know, we've been doing all of these events featuring some of the book contributors, which have been really fun and exciting. We just did one in D.C. in partnership with Political Parity and Running Start and WFPAC. These are some groups that, you know, empower women into, especially younger women, into political office. We had some of the women's congresswomen from the book appeared at that event. There's, you know, several online platforms that are emerging. You know, I'm trying to really use the book to shine a light on all of the organizations that are working on different prongs of this issue. And also just, you know, I do think that it's what I see happening is that women sort of are kind of awakening to just the need to start to get involved. And sometimes things have to get so bad to do that, you know, in some ways. But also I think the thing that's most encouraging to me has been the men. And we had Gavin Newsom appeared at Lieutenant Governor of California at our San Francisco event. Don McPherson, who's an NFL veteran and social activist, appeared at both the New York and D.C. events. Men speaking up, I think, is one of the most promising signs that I'm seeing, because you need men on board to support this. And again, the reframing that this isn't, you know, a women's issue and we all benefit is probably the most important message, you know, to come out of this. But when you were talking about, you know, this whole problem of powerful women being seen in a negative light, that's why, you know, the media and looking at, you know, becoming sort of very actively involved and educated consumers of media is important. Because, you know, we need to start to call out sexist media. When the cover of Time magazine came out, and I don't know if you remember this, with Hillary, she had this, it was like this, her pantsuited leg, and there was this little tiny man under her stiletto heel that she was like going to crush. I don't know if you remember seeing this Time magazine cover.
Yeah, I don't remember.
I was compelled to write a piece for Huffington Post about it because it was such a sexist image, you know. There was for no reason that she was like with her little heel going to crush a little man underneath it. I mean, you know, I just think we have to not take these things for granted because they stick in our psyche and they affect, you know, as I said, women how they see themselves and men how they see female leaders.
And that's
well,
why
there's no question that we
just,
view. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say on that, just in terms of how women are perceived and treated in general, there's all of these movements going on now about addressing street harassment, something that women have tolerated forever and ever, you know, walking past the construction sites or that particular corner, where it's even calling them out on that. So if we can't get them to clean up the street, how could we possibly make space for, you know, in the boardrooms if we can't even get the streets cleaned?
Women are, you know, definitely objectified in so many ways, again, perpetuated by the media. But I think even some of these recent stories that we're hearing, whether it's about, you know, rapes in India or about these, you know, poor Nigerian schoolgirls, I mean, I think that, you know, women and girls are just not really valued in the world right now. And I think, though, what I'm feeling is a collective uprising against that recently, which I think, you know, it has to be almost like, you know, a global awareness and movement, because I think for too long there's been a little bit of a complacency, especially in this country. I mean, I think that, you know, again, we have this sense that somehow we're farther along than we are. I was often reminded, though, during my interviews that, and it seems almost like surreal, like science fiction, but that there was a time that women didn't even have the right to vote. And so
not that long ago.
I know. And it's, so when you put it in that perspective, I mean, we've made progress, but, you know, there's still a ways to go. And when you think about the energy around, you know, the suffragette movement, we need that kind of, like, uprising, I think, now, to push it forward, and not in a way, again, that is like feels at all anti-male. This is, you know, as I think it was Jane Fonda who said to me, the opposite of patriarchy is not matriarchy, it's democracy. Men can't
right.
feel threatened by this, that, you know, women, it's not women wanting to take over the world. We just, you know, want to be an equal stewardship, which seems, you know, a reasonable thing
right.
to ask. So, you know, again, it's definitely, you know, it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be quick. But I think that the more we have conversations like these are helpful.
But it's, you know, when you talk about corporate media perpetuating this, isn't it really the larger problem when you talk about the monolithic, you know, hegemonic media that is, you know, when you take the money now in terms of, you know, Citizens United and the fact that we have the ability, money is speech, and you have those that are able to, you know, buy and get out the voice that might not be in the best interest of women. And by when I talk about women, I'm also talking about women and their allies, all of us progressives, all of us in that are trying to advance social issues that you've mentioned throughout all of this. None of this, it's not feminism, it's not women's rights in a vacuum. So if we're talking about the things that are important to women, you know, reproductive rights, wealth inequality, you know, healthcare and the accessibility to it. Those are the issues, and the fact that the, you know, the sort of corporate media will still insist on showing 15-year-old girls in ads, you know, to sell beer. Is that sort of the underlying, is the problem not the men? Because as you, when you interviewed, you know, Professor Kimmel and mm-hmm. other men and essentially everyone, I'm sure the people in the travel in your circles, Marian, are, you know, talk the talk and walk the walk, and we're getting there. As you mentioned, this is not that long ago. It was how many, you know, less than a century when it was less than, I think one of your interviewees just talked about in her lifetime that, you know, she heard the words, why bother going to college? You're a girl.
That was Joy Behar.
You know, and that
yep.
she couldn't get a credit, maybe that was Joy Behar, and she couldn't mm-hmm. get a credit card even in her lifetime
yep.
in her name. So we have, you know, again, people will say, and some people I know will say, well, what do you, you know, this is better than it's ever been in modern history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's never been better, never mm-hmm. had more equality for, this is, I'm playing devil's advocate for mm-hmm. minorities and for women. But now, won't we find ourselves in a place where it really is in some ways worse than it's ever been before because we face climate change issues. Women, I think, would bring, perhaps, mm-hmm. with more female voices, we wouldn't be, you know, as willfully ignorant as we are now about climate change. Just, again, bringing in some other voices that aren't simply, you know, bellicose male voices that are, you know, cheerleaders for, you know, corporate interests. That's mm-hmm. all. I mean, do these conversations that we all have take place, they're not taking place in a vacuum because these problems end up sort of drowning out,
mm-hmm.
you know, the issues. If we had more women but we still had the ability to spend, you know, to have Shelley Adelson spend $5 billion of his own money on the candidate that he wants that is not mm-hmm. in favor of any issues important to women, we all lose, including mm-hmm. women. Is that part of the conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a multi-pronged conversation. And even when you talk about, for example, you know, the media, I mean, you know, women are in only, I think it was, this is from Jennifer Siebel Newsom, who's the writer-director of Misrepresentation, which was a great documentary on this, in less than 5% of clout positions in the media. So, you know, it's a problem that's so infiltrated into our culture and systems that it is sort of, hard to uproot. But, you know, I think what I found, you know, I'm very interested right now in including men into the conversation. In fact, Feminist.com is doing a Men and Women as Allies event in the fall in partnership with Michael Kimmel and his organization, the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinity, is that I think we have to – I think it's a mistake to not look at how gender roles negatively impact men and boys too, even in how they are leaders. Because I think even
right.
for men who reach there, they feel they have to be warlike and they have to be tough and they have to not, you know, some of these issues are seen as, quote, you know, women's issues so that they don't think to advocate for them. And so to me, you have to do both. You have to, look at all of the ways that these very constrictive gender roles are impacting men and women, you know, together and sort of rethink leadership and power differently in general. So, you know, as I said, what I discovered in having this one simple question was that it is this, like, you know, umbrella question that has so many other different prongs. But I feel mostly optimistic, as dispiriting as some of those things that you're saying, and a sense of a little bit of complacency. Maybe it's the role of the internet. Maybe it's just the energy. You know, I've been taking the book and going to speak on all sorts of, you know, college campuses. The energy from young people today, who, especially young women, who are so empowered and so ready to take on the world, just really just looking for, you know, resources and mentors and the encouragement to do it. I feel like the energy is in the right direction that's there, but, mm-hmm. you know, I do think that it does take unifying efforts, interconnecting movements. You know, this is just as much, you have to look at this from a lens of being about diversity, so it is just as much about uprooting, you know, racism as it is about sexism. So I think it's right. A lot of linkages that I think need to happen and are happening.
So the most important, what do you identify as the most important issues to you right now?
Well,
in terms of the...
Yeah. All of everything I just talked about. You know, I think in general, it's just, you know, it's everybody awakening to their own sense of power. I mean, one of the things I heard from interviewing Gavin Newsom, aside from the fact of him, you know, speaking to the issues that are specific to, you know, women in the book, was this notion of how everybody has to now be sort of an active and informed citizen. And that we all have power, whether it's as, you know, in terms of the media that we support and consume, whether it's voting, whether it's supporting a candidate that we believe in or running for office ourselves. I think no matter how we want to manifest it, I think it's an awakening of our own, like, inner leader, not to sound corny, to be a change agent in the world. And I think anything on any of these prongs that we've been discussing is going to be helpful. And I think there is not just one I could single out, other than I think just generally the call to action that we do need women, you know, at the table, and we do need just a reflective democracy and diversity in order to address, you know, the challenges that we face.
So
I always like that phrase, women at the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we're not, you know, at the table. And so, you know, it's when, again, when you look at some of these tables that are deciding such important, you know, decisions, when you don't have women there, especially, like, there was, I think it was a Republican senator, I quote him a lot in the book, Rob Portman, who said that, you know, women do tend to bring, even just in the limited numbers, a different climate in terms of communication and being consensus builders. I think those tables would, you know, react differently in how they, you know, communicate around things. I think there were a couple, the female senators, they all get together and they have these dinners, I think, every few months. And, you know, where they talk about their personal lives, they don't talk about issues. They just, you know, connect as human beings so that when they then go back to talking about issues, even if they're not in agreement, they're not political adversaries. They're connecting as human beings. And I think we need more situations like that.
Well, first, Marianne, I thank you for being here. It's clearly very important work that you're doing. The book is catalyzing, and I think for you that it's catalyzing all these conversations, you know, around the country, on campuses, or all the events that you're doing, right? The book is the catalyst. The book is, you know, is sort of the metaphor and the symbol for these discussions that do empower women. And it's amazing that it came out of, you know, a conversation or a question from your daughter. So, you know, I thank you for the great work that you're doing. And, you know, the question is, what's next for you? How do you take the work that you've done and move from here? What's the next project, that your next passion, the next book?
Well, apparently I do have ideas, you know, I'm moving forward on a next book, but that's ways off. This book apparently still has a lot of life, probably through, I would imagine, you know, who knows, the next year or two. So there's a lot keeping me busy. We are definitely, there are plans in place to do a tour. There are plans in place to launch a whole online hub where that will be spotlighted around sort of women's leadership, empowering new generation of women leaders. So I definitely am planning to use the book to continue these great conversations, because they've been really fun to do. And there are a lot of partners who want to partner with me on this. We have that section at Political Parity. There's audio clips from the interviews and all sorts of research. I'm going to be doing more interviews. I'm also going to be doing interviews for a lot of other platforms like Levo League. I'm continuing the work at Feminist.com. And there's a lot brewing behind the scenes around this book, because I think one of the things I've always done in my work has been as a convener. And this is such a great opportunity to, as I said, to use the book to continue the conversation and to spotlight all of the thought leaders, activists, and organizations that are working on so many prongs of the, you know, these themes. So I expect that to keep me busy for a while, even before my next book. And you know, and I'm happy to do so. It's something that, you know, has a lot of energy to it, and you know, I think is important.
Well good on you. That's terrific. Congratulations on the success of the book.
Yeah, but especially coming up in 2015, leading up to the next presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just the awareness raising that this book is bringing. Timely.
What can people do, Marianne, you know, people who may be listening, and for young people who say, okay, that's, you know, terrific, and as like the energy when you speak to college students, what can individual people do right now to get involved for themselves, for others, to keep the momentum going when they say, well, I'm not a so-called thought leader, I'm not in a position like you are now to make sort of a larger impact and to get the message out, and mm-hmm. to be supportive. I think you say in the acknowledgement section of your book that's the women, and we all need, women need support networks, as you say mm-hmm. about, you know, your life and your husband and all the people that sort of mm-hmm. were part of bringing this book to fruition. What can individual people do to support the women's rights movement as you see it today?
Well, I think it's something as simple as, you know, encouraging our daughters. You know, making sure that we're encouraging them to see themselves as leaders and to value their, you know, their voices. Certainly if we know a woman that we think would make a good candidate for office, to encourage them to run. If you're someone who would make a good candidate for office, to run, you know, run yourself, run for elected office, or find other ways to, you know, contribute to change. I talked before about becoming just an educated consumer of media or speaking out against sexist media. That's really important. I think supporting, you know, when you hear about legislation, for example, legislation that Kirsten Gillibrand's trying to pass, which is support working women and families in areas around, you know, supporting for, you know, paid maternity leave and equal pay, universal pre-K, affordable daycare. These are important programs. And, you know, just in general, I think, you know, using your voice to advocate for women and speak out when we, you know, hear about, you know, where women are not being, you know, treated equally. So I think there's a lot that everybody can do, but, you know, I think that you have just as much power as a parent as you do, you know, as an official leader. And even in terms of what I hear a lot on the college campuses, there are young women looking for mentors, and there are a lot of older women who I think would love to be a mentor. And I think forging those type of alliances are also important. I think one of the things I've been thinking about is launching a mentoring network. I think that just women supporting each other and men supporting women around these issues, I think, will go a long way.
Does your husband, here's a personal question because it sort of resonates for me. Is your husband a feminist?
Oh, for sure. In fact, way back in the day, he started a page at Feminist.com called Meninist. Swear to God, if you Google it, you'll find it. Absolutely, and has been from day one. And right now he's with, you know, my children, and he definitely shares, you know, equally in the parenting. And, well, I would not say he's 50-50 in terms of domestic stuff in the home. And, you know, but, you know, we're working on it. But, you know, what I think is so important, you know, to say here is that we do need to support men, too, in changing their roles, because I think, you know, these things are seen as unmanly. I've heard of a lot of women stigmatizing men who are staying home with their kids and not inviting them to, like, the, quote, mommy and me classes. I mean, we have to provide an environment where men feel able and safe in sharing these roles and that they're not perceived as unmanly. So I think that's as much. Gloria Steinem, you know, hate to keep coming back to Gloria, stressed that, too, that was just as important for, you know, that women be seen as authoritative and as leaders, as that men are seen as caretakers and nurturers. So, you know, as it's very important that we support men in doing that, too.
Mm. So a man can be, you know, there's, I read an article recently that said, you know, if a male feminist or a feminist who is a male saying I'm a feminist is sort of somewhat oxymoronic. It's sort of like the meme, you know, the yes, all women versus, you know, all men can, right, you know, hashtag. Is there, so your husband proudly would stand up and say, I am, of course, a feminist. There's nothing, there's no other, he doesn't need to be a meninist. Is the point, or a memonist.
You need to be a human being. I mean, the interview that had so much effect on me was talking to President Carter, whose book Call to Action is about the horrendous, you know, human rights abuses against women across this globe. And this is now, he doesn't have any reason to have to do this right now, but this has become his, you know, his calling, because we're all human beings. You know, men, you know, if feminism, and I always go by the dictionary definition of, you know, social, political, economic equality of the sexes. You know, it's for a man not to support that, you know, that there would be equality. You know, I think the problem is there's all so many misconceptions about what feminism is. And when you just look at it from that lens, you know, it's hard to imagine any man, I mean, they are out there, but, you know, that would not support that. And, you know, so, again, I think a lot of the reason why maybe some men are reluctant to call themselves as because they think that it's somehow man-hating and all these things that, at least in my version of feminism, it is completely not. And maybe I surround myself with people like Michael Kimmel and, you know, Don McPherson and Jimmy Briggs and these amazing men who are such huge advocates, you know, on these issues, that, you know, I know that it's possible. And to me, it's stranger when a man is not a feminist. That is something I'm more, you know, question and
right,
about.
Right, right. Where is President Carter in the book? I didn't see him here in my version of it.
Well, you know, I didn't interview him for the book. I interviewed him for Huffington Post when his book came out. I would have loved to have interviewed him in retrospect, and I did send him a copy of my book after the interview. But, you know.
Right. He's my favorite president. He's the only president. He put solar panels on the White
yep.
House. Ronald Reagan came in and removed. And he's the only president that didn't have a war, his own little, you know, little mini war. That he did for his to raise his you know, level of popularity. How was he to interview? What was he like?
It's hard for me to imagine being as moved during an interview as I was by talking to him, because his level and passion and commitment on this is so genuine and sincere and moving. You know, because he really has taken this on as his cause. I mean, he is just really disturbed. He's seen things on a global scale through his work with the Carter Center. I mean, we haven't talked about this during our interview, but the things that are happening to women and girls globally are the atrocities that are happening are almost just, you know, on the scale that they're happening are just, you know, horrifying. So I found him to be, I mean, he didn't hold anything back. He is speaking the truth as he sees it. I think he is just absolutely horrified that this goes on, and he's using, you know, these years of his life where he could just be sort of resting on his laurels, you know, going around and writing books and giving speeches just on, you know, this issue about women's global human rights. So I was so inspired by him, and he could not have been more, you know, gracious and humble and caring during our interview.
And that's what you said. It's not about whether or not President Carter, who must be over 90 by now, do you know how old he is?
I feel like he's like 89 or something like that, yeah.
Globe-trotting and doing what he doesn't need to do. But here's a man who may very well not identify as a feminist, but he's a human being, a humanist.
May I say that he did, actually,
did he?
Not during my interview, but he did publicly, like you can Google it in a video clip, he did very proudly identify himself as a feminist.
That's outstanding. In your interview as well?
No, I should have asked him that. I didn't, but I saw it. It went viral, you know, a couple of weeks later, because in one of his interviews, he absolutely, without reservation, called himself a feminist. So we need more men doing that. So,
right.
And we can find that. Anyone wants to just Google that, you know, your interview in HuffPost with President Jimmy Carter?
Yeah, it's all absolutely. And they're all, you know, my everything's on my website, MarianneChenault.com.
Okay.
And hopefully that'll also be a place until the big grand hub that we're launching that you can, you know, stay in touch and stay tuned also through feminist.com on wherever this movement is going, because it's been a pretty exciting adventure.
Mm. Outstanding. Anything else you want to talk about today with us?
No, just thank you so much for having me and for, you know, the very, you know, interesting conversation. I appreciate the work that you guys do as well.
Thank you for being here. Deborah, is there anything you'd like to ask Marianne before she leaves
other
us?
Other than to say thank you. This was really great, and I was scribbling notes the whole time.
Okay, fabulous. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Marianne.
Okay, take care.
We'll see you soon.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.